So I discussed, I'm discussing the acronym MIND. M was the mind magnifies problems. Then I was the mind imagines pleasures, which was what we discussed yesterday. How there is pleasure in material existence, but the mind imagines that it is far, far greater than what it actually is. And in that way, especially this imagination is the momentum which takes, by which the mind drags us into undesirable activities. And then we discussed about how this imagination of the mind can be checked by the external barricade of rules, social rules, by the internal break of our own realizations, and it can be redirected, spiritualized through the principles of Manasa Puja and Manasa Seva. Today I'll discuss the next two parts. N is the mind neglects opportunities, and D will be the mind denies realities. So these two are related. Neglects opportunities. Now, when I talked about the mind magnifies problems, at that time one feature I had mentioned is how in the present we have a problem, but the mind adds the past and the future to the present and burdens us unnecessarily. So, same way, the mind neglects the opportunities, makes us neglect whatever opportunities are there. How is that? In one sense, this point is related with the first. But here I will focus on one peculiar way in which the mind deludes us. That is, through misappropriation of the feeling of guilt. Guilt is the natural human response, human psychological response to harmful behavior. Just like in our body, if there is a wound, when there is a wound, if there is a cut in the body, then there is natural, the body's immune system gets activated, the WBCs come out and the white blood corpuscles come out, and then clotting and healing takes place. So sometimes when some pathogens, some germs come into the body may heat its own temperature to try to defend itself and drive it out. So just as there is a biochemical or physical defense mechanism, similarly, there is also a psychological defense mechanism. What is that psychological defense mechanism? That is our conscience and the feeling of guilt that comes when we do something against our conscience. So internally, we are prompted to avoid doing wrong things and to do right things. Now this conscience is, as Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto mattah smritir jnanam apohanam cha. So sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto, that I am situated in the hearts of all living beings. And he guides us from within. Now the conscience can be culturally conditioned. That means that, say for example, if somebody has grown from childhood in a culture where meat eating is the norm, then a person may not feel anything wrong while eating meat. On the other hand, if a person has grown in a culture where meat eating is not done, it's frowned upon, then when a person eats meat, there will be a twinge of conscience. The pinch of conscience. So the conscience can be culturally conditioned. But underlying the cultural conditioning, there is a principle that everyone accepts that there is something which is right and something that is wrong. What is right and what is wrong may vary according to person to person. But there is this principle of rightness and wrongness. So now if somebody says, hey, you are unfair at that time. If somebody accuses, A accuses B, you are unfair when you spoke like that. Then that person may explain, okay, why I spoke like that, even if I was unfair, why I was unfair. Or, actually I was not unfair. But in both ways, in a person tries to defend, a person assumes that unfairness is bad and it may have to be, then I'll try to explain how I am not unfair, or I will try to say circumstances forced me to behave the way I did. So the point which I am making is, human people accept that we should not be unfair. They may be unfair in certain situations. So now, the conscience, the viveka buddhi which we have, which is called in Sanskrit viveka, the capacity of discrimination, this, we can look at it from a philosophical perspective, from a social, as I explained, from a cultural perspective, different people may consider different things to be wrong. From a philosophical perspective, the conscience can be conditioned by the modes. So in goodness, passion and ignorance. Because goodness is close to transcendence. So in goodness, the conscience is the clearest. In ignorance, the conscience is the dimmest. So for example, if a person is a serial killer, a person's conscience has become so dimmed, so dulled, so deadened that the person commits murder and doesn't feel anything. Why is that? Because one has distanced oneself from the voice of conscience, alienated oneself completely. So that voice of conscience is there in all of us, but if we can go towards it, we can go away from it. And this is meant to protect us. See, we all want to feel good about ourselves. And feel good about ourselves, not in an egoistic sense, but in the sense that conscience uses this natural tendency about our wanting to feel good about ourselves and protects us from doing wrong things. So, if you consider these five fingers, remove this one. So, this is the soul, this is Krishna, and okay.
Sorry.
Okay, so this is some wrong activity. Actually, I don't have much control over my motor nervous system.
So that's why.
Okay, anyway. So, okay, I'll do it like this. Okay, there are these three things. This is some wrong activity. This is the soul. And this is Krishna. So, some wrongdoing is there. The voice of conscience should come here. And when I start doing something wrong, then the voice of conscience stops me. It makes me feel guilt. So, the guilt is like a watchdog. Just like when a thief comes, and a dog barks, stop, stop, stop. The feeling of guilt is like a watchdog that starts barking when the sinful desire comes into us, or we are prompted towards sinful action. So when sin comes into our consciousness, the guilt is the watchdog that barks, or rather conscience gives the feeling of guilt and makes us want to stop from doing it. However, the mind is so sinister. The mind is so sinister that instead of this guilt coming between us and the wrongdoing, the feeling of guilt comes between us and Krishna. The feeling of guilt is meant to protect us from going away from Krishna, but the mind makes the feeling of guilt come between us and Krishna. How is that? That actually, if I have done something wrong, then yes, it's natural to feel bad. But what is the solution? I have to take shelter of Krishna. And by taking shelter of Krishna, I can purify myself. But when we do some mistake, when something wrong happens, then the mind makes us say, you are like this only. You are a good for nothing person. You are a fallen person. You are a sinful person. And in this way, the mind disheartens us in our practice of bhakti. And that guilt actually prevents us from going closer towards Krishna. Rather, it makes us relax in the process that will take us towards Krishna. So when guilt comes between us and Krishna, instead of coming between us and the wrongdoing, then what is coming in between us and Krishna, that is not guilt, that is pseudo-guilt.
Why
It is pseudo-guilt, pseudo-guilt, false guilt. It is actually a form of temptation. Normally, we think of temptation as lust, anger, greed. But in a generic sense, anything that takes us away from Krishna is a temptation. So, normally, when we feel guilty, when guilt feelings come, that should make us take shelter of Krishna. We have songs like Amara Jeevana Sada Paperata, where Bhaktivinoda Thakur expresses amazing humility. But the end of such songs is that he wholeheartedly takes shelter of Krishna. Krishna, you only can save me. And I take shelter of you. But in our case, when we feel guilty, that guilt makes us disheartened. What is the point? I cannot practice bhakti. To give an example, I'll give 2-3 different examples. Suppose a boxing match is going on. Two boxers are fighting. And one boxer gives a big punch. And his boxer B falls down. Now after the boxer B has fallen down, he's knocked out, but not yet knocked out. So when there's a strong blow like that, what should the boxer do? The boxer should look around at one's own coach and ask the coach, what should I do? And when you look at the coach and ask the coach, come on, fight, you can fight, get up. The coach will give some guidance. But if instead, if the boxer has fallen down, he asks the coach, will I be able to fight? Will I be able to win? The coach will encourage, yes, you can fight, you can win. But if instead, this boxer has fallen down, the boxer consults his opponent only. Can I win? Never! Never! So, what happens is, first the mind knocks us down. The mind makes us do wrong things. And then the mind says, you are never going to do well. So first the mind makes us do the wrong thing. And then we end up consulting the same mind. Will I be able to do the right thing? The mind is never going to say that you can do the right thing. So in that way, the mind, by its discouragement, it keeps us away from Krishna. And actually at this time, we may be feeling bad. Why did I do such a thing? Why did I do that wrong thing? Why did I do that? Why did I do that? Now, that feeling of regret or remorse or repentance when we do something wrong, all that is healthy if it takes us towards Krishna. But we know that past time, and Srila Prabhupada, some devotee told Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada, I am the most fallen. So Srila Prabhupada said, you are the most nothing. I am the most fallen in this. The mind is so sinister that I am fallen, we may say, but the mind gradually shifts the focus from fallen to I. So, mind shifts the focus from fallen to I. That means we become self-centered, we go into a mode of self-pity. And self-pity is not humility. Self-pity, and I feel keep feeling sorry for myself, oh, this is wrong with me, this is like this, this is like that. So, we ultimately want to be Krishna-centered, not self-centered. So, if even the feelings of guilt make us self-centered, oh, I am so fallen, I am so this, I am so that, I am useless, I can never change. All that is happening is, we are becoming I-centered. We are not becoming Krishna-centered. So, this is the mind's trick by which it keeps us away from Krishna. So, there is a prayer in the Puranas. Bhuskhalita padana bhumir eva padam. Tvai jata pradhana tvam eva sharanam vibho. Just as a small infant, while trying to walk, taking the first steps, an infant slips and falls flat on the ground. That small child, how is the child going to rise again? It is by taking shelter of the same floor on which the child has fallen. Similarly, you know, the prayer is, O Lord, I have committed so many offenses to you. But it is only by taking shelter of you that I will rise again. So if anything makes us disheartened in taking shelter of Krishna, we should know that that is Maya for us. Anything that makes us disheartened in taking shelter of Krishna, even if that disheartenment seems to be coming from a valid cause, such as our own misdeeds, but even if we have done something wrong, that does not mean that we have to stop practicing bhakti. The only way we can stop doing wrong is by practicing bhakti more intensely. So, but when the mind denies opportunity, what it means is that when we have an opportunity to do something, to correct something wrong we had done in the past, the mind makes us so caught in self-pity that it does not let us do what we can do to set things right. So we neglect the opportunity for doing something by which we could correct ourselves. There is, you know, we may not be consistent, but we can be resilient. We may not be consistent, but we can be resilient. Consistent means always being able to do a high standard of practice daily, every day, day in, day out. That's consistency. Now, consistency is difficult as long as we have not come to the mode of goodness. Krishna says, Yesham tu antagatam papam jananam punya karmanam te dvanda moha nirmukta bhajante maam drudavrataha. So here in 7.28 he says that bhajante maam drudavrataha. When can we practice bhakti determinedly? When yesham tu antagatam papam. When we have become free from sinful activities. Jananam punya karmanam. When we have actually done pious activities for several lifetimes, then we will be able to te dvandva moha nirmukta. At that time, being free from the delusions caused by duality, we will be bhajante maam drudavrata. So, determined practice of bhakti is not so easy. But just because our practice of bhakti is not consistent, that does not mean that we have to give up the practice. Yes, as I said, this boxer falls down, is knocked down by the opponent. The boxer can get up again and fight. So consistency means going on at the same level regularly. If we can't be consistent, we can be resilient. Resilient means, even if I fall, I rise again. Even if I fall, I rise again. Thank you. So in that way, we can continue practicing bhakti. So what the mind does is, because I have fallen down, what is the point of rising again? Even if I rise again, I am going to fall. Even if I rise again, I am going to fall. So what is the point? Then, in this way, the mind makes us disheartened. So, if we look at our worldly desires, which often cause us to do wrong. Now, the worldly desires, it is not that they are constantly tormenting us. Yes, there is some level of agitation that is there constantly. But the temptations, if we consider the graph of temptations, there are spikes. The desires become very strong. And at that time, it's almost impossible to resist them. At least at that time, we feel it is impossible. And when those desires become very high, the spikes come up. Like we have electric current, sometimes there are spikes. And the electric current becomes very high. So like that, our desires are going like this, and then suddenly the spike goes up. When suddenly a strong desire comes up, the desire increases sometimes. So now, when that spike-like desire becomes very strong, at that time, it may be not so easy for us to resist. And at that time, we may succumb. And even if we are not able to resist when those desires become very high, what is important is what we do between the spikes. That, yes, there's something
strong desire came and I did something wrong. Afterwards, a strong desire may come. It's not that it's going to be there 24 hours a day. So, in between what we do is very important. If we are purifying ourselves in between, the next time the strong desire comes, we'll be better prepared to face it. And if we keep practicing, even if something wrong happens, the important thing is that we, by making sure that in between, we don't let our bhakti be stopped. We will purify ourselves, we will become stronger. So now, why do these spikes come? These spikes come because of our past conditionings. Or presently also we may get tempted by certain things. But either way, when the spikes come, they may not be in our control immediately. But just because something is not in our control, that does not mean that nothing is in our control. So that is the trick of the mind. It denies the opportunity. Yes, sometimes the desires may become so strong. For example, simple level. I may decide I am not going to overeat. But next time there is an opportunity, I overeat. And then, it's one thing to overeat. But when we overeat, it is not just that we eat the food. We let the food eat us. We let the food eat us means we dwell on it so much. Why did I overeat? Why did I overeat? Why did I overeat? Why did I overeat? So now, that's not required. When Prabhupada was asked, what do you do if you overeat? Prabhupada said, okay, if you overeat, work hard. Work hard for Krishna. So what happens is, okay, I may have some time overeaten, but I don't have to let that thought eat me up. What do I do in the remaining time? So, because of some wrong things that we may do, the mind makes us so disheartened that all the other time, when we have the opportunity to do something right, we don't do it. So, in this way, the mind makes us neglect opportunities. So, we are defined in our bhakti not by how we fall, but by how we rise. We will all fall. And falling will happen? Yes. But how we rise, that is what is going to matter in the long run. If we keep rising, we will be keep moving onwards on our bhakti. And this brings us to the next point. D is denies reality. Now, there are various levels of reality. Now, one level the mind denies is that I'm going to die. The mind very forcefully denies the temporary nature of material existence. So, there's one Greek philosopher, he said that death will never happen to me. Why? Because when I am there, that is not there. And when death will be there, I will not be there.
Some twisted logic is not going to save one from death. And
the point is, the mind denies the reality of death. That's one level of denial. And I'll focus on another aspect of the denial, that the mind denies the highest reality. The highest reality in all of existence is the reality of Krishna's love for us. Krishna loves us not because of who we are, but because of who He is. Krishna loves us not because of who we are, but because of who He is. That means He is the all-loving Supreme Person. Surudam Sarvabhutanam. He is the benefactor, the well-wisher of all living beings. So His love for us is not dependent on us. His love for us is because He is loving. Yes, what is dependent is our experience of His love. Krishna loves us always. But if our consciousness is turned away from Him, we can't experience His love. Just like the sun gives light, if I close my eyes, the sun doesn't stop giving light. But I can't see that light. So like that, if we start chasing after worldly objects, we start loving worldly things, then we cut off our ability to experience Krishna's love. But Krishna keeps loving us. And this The mind denies this reality. The mind makes us imagine that, oh, I'm all alone struggling in this world. The whole big bad world is against me and I am all alone. How will I fight? And again, by denying the reality of Krishna's love, the mind keeps us away from Krishna. Going back to that earlier example, earlier verse I quoted, that Bhajante Mam Drudavrataha, that we can become determined in our practice of bhakti only after we are purified. But Krishna, by the end of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo Mokshayishyami Mashuchaha. Krishna says, you just surrender to me and I will free you from sinful reactions. So in 7.28 he is saying, you become free from sinful reactions, you become free from sin, then you can become determined. But by 18.66 he is saying, however you are, you just surrender to me. And even if there are sins, I will free you from those sins. So, in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, the Acharya has given an example there, that when a mother is training her child, giving potty training to the child, you know, when you have to respond to nature, you should go to the toilet and respond, or you should respond here. And if the child messes up, you know, dirties one's clothes, and the mother seems to get angry, it says, don't come close to me unless you have cleaned yourself. Clean up the mess, don't come to me otherwise. Now, if the baby says, I don't know how to clean myself, what is the mother going to do? They'll pick her up and clean the baby. So like that, when Krishna is saying that Yesham tu antagatam papam jananam punya karmana, you become pure, then you come to me. That like mother saying, you know, you first clean yourself, then you come to me. But when the baby says, when the conditions of, I don't know how to clean myself, Krishna says, you come to me, I will purify you. Aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami mashuchaha. So, I will purify you from all sinful reactions. So, the point is, Krishna's love for us is the highest reality in all of existence. And to the extent we live in the light of this reality, to that extent, the mind's troubles will become lesser and lesser. What the mind does is that it makes us build a wall around our heart. And then it complains, I am feeling lonely. It makes us build a wall around our heart. That means, it makes us forget that right next to us, in our heart, Krishna is there. Krishna loves us. And Krishna is always accessible to us, if we just turn to Him in devotion. But having distracted us from Krishna, having blinded us to Krishna's love, then afterwards, it's, oh, you are alone, no one cares for you, this world is such a big, bad place, what can you do? And in that way, the mind again makes us discouraged. So generally, when problems come in life, the tendency of the mind is to try to cast blame. One way is, if some problem comes in my life, we blame the world. Because this person did like this, because this person did like this, this person did like this. The other is, we blame ourselves. I am such a fool, I am such an idiot, I am such nonsense. And the third is, we blame God. So, God doesn't exist or God doesn't care. So basically, actually, none of these three responses are helpful. Now, if we blame God, then we cut ourselves off the supreme help that is available to us. If we blame others, then we lose whatever opportunity we may have to correct ourselves and improve. Now, what about blaming ourselves? Blaming ourselves, if it is done in a mood in which we can actually feel encouraged and inspired to improve, that is good. Otherwise, by blaming ourselves, if we become disheartened, if we become discouraged, then that self-blame is also a, it's a negative form of self-centeredness. Normally when you talk about self-centeredness, it is like self-centeredness is, you know, I am so good, I am so great, I am so this, I am so that. But the mind can take the same thing in the opposite way and make us self-centered. Oh, I am so bad, I am so fallen, I am so this, I am so that. Just like to give a physical example of this. Most people, they want to look very good. They want to look, they may dress very attractively, have a lot of makeup, use the latest, best personal care items, so that they look very attractive, and then they attract attention to others. They attract attention of others. And that is the way they want to be the center. Now that same tendency, wanting to be the center, can come in a perverse way in some people. And that is among hypochondriacs. Now people who act as if they are sick. And they act as if they are sick for what purpose? To attract attention. Oh, I am so sick, I had this disease, I had this problem, I had this, I had that. Some small rash that may be there, they may make it imagine it's like a fracture. So, this basically, whether a person is looking, trying to look very good or is trying to look very sick, underlying both of them, the mentality is self-centeredness. So, just as this can happen at a physical level, it can also happen at an inner level. Wherein at one level, I want to portray to the world how good I am, how clever I am, how impressive I am, and gain attention that way. And the other is by telling, oh, how useless I am, how good for nothing I am, how fallen I am. That way also, the same self-centeredness can be expressed in a negative way. So, our process of purification centers on remembrance of Krishna. Centers on keeping Krishna at the center. And if any trick of the mind makes us think less of Krishna and think more and more about ourselves, then that is a temptation. That is a temptation which we need to resist. So even if I am very fallen, even if I am good for nothing, but still Krishna loves me. Apichet sudara charo bhajate mam ananya bhavak sadhureva samantavya samyak vyavasito hi saha. So Krishna says that my devotee is to be considered saintly even if the devotee has done a terrible activity. What this verse tells us that there is nothing that we can do which can stop Krishna from loving us. There is nothing that we can do that can stop Krishna from loving us. There is nothing that we can do because of which Krishna will say, I am fed up with you. I will leave your heart and go away. No. Krishna will always be there in our heart. Matru prapanna pashupasha vimokshanaya muktaya bhuri karunaya namo layaya. Gajendra in his prayers says, O Lord, you are so merciful. I am pashupasha. I am caught in this, caught by this animal. He is referring to animal, not just the crocodile which is caught in. He is also talking about the bodily conception of life, which is animalistic. So he says, I am caught in that. And please, O Lord, liberate me from it. Why is it? Muktaya. You are liberated. So you can liberate me. But the Lord may say that you are bound by your own karma. Why should I liberate you? Bhuri karunaya. You are extremely merciful. So you please liberate me. Yes, by my karma, I deserve to be bound. But you are merciful. So please, bhuri karunaya, liberate me. Then the Lord may say, I have tried to liberate you so many times. You never listened to me. So, alayaya. My dear Lord, you never get tired. You never get tired. So, there is nothing that can make Krishna so fed up with us. He will say, I don't care for you. There is nothing that we can do which can make Krishna stop loving us. So, if this reality, if we can understand this and keep that in the center of our consciousness, even as a theoretical understanding, even if we can't, even if we don't have much realization of this, even as a theoretical principle, if we keep this in mind, that will enable us to resist the various ways in which the mind distracts us. So, ultimately, everything else, as I discussed the earlier three things, the mind magnifies problems, it imagines pleasures, it neglects opportunities. Now, all those are true. But the fundamental problem is, the mind denies the reality of Krishna's love for us. The Prabhupada would say that, and Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur told him that, the biggest problem in the world is a lack of Krishna consciousness. Now, what does Krishna consciousness mean? It's a profound phrase. Krishna consciousness, at one level we can say it means we being conscious of Krishna, in the sense of we consciously strive to fix our consciousness on Krishna. That is Krishna consciousness. But to get the inspiration, to get the motivation, to struggle to fix our consciousness on Krishna, if we can have even a lesser level, a more preliminary level of Krishna consciousness, that is, that yes, Krishna exists, Krishna cares. Yes, Krishna cares. If we just, Krishna loves me and loves me more than anyone else, then that will inspire us to be Krishna conscious. What does that mean? That the Krishna consciousness can also be at multiple levels. So Krishna consciousness can mean my conscious attempt to recollect Krishna, to think of Krishna. But before that, even if I have the preliminary level of consciousness that yes, Krishna loves me, then that will inspire me. Okay, then why should, if Krishna loves me, why should I think about this and that and that? Let me think about Krishna. So that ability to fix the mind on Krishna constantly, that will take a long time for us to come to. But even if our focus on Krishna is intermittent right now, but even with that intermittent focus, we can move onwards towards it. I'll conclude with one point, then we can have question answers. In our spiritual life, sometimes we may become very proud, thinking that, oh, I have done so much service, I have made so much advancement, or I'm so good at this, I'm so good at that. So at that time, if we start becoming proud, we need to look at how far we have to go. We have to look at, now if you look at the way the Goswamis practice bhakti, we look at the way how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to cry tears of ecstasy. By looking at how far we have to go, we can develop humility. We can avoid pride. But sometimes the opposite can also happen. We become discouraged. I have been practicing bhakti for so long. What has happened? I'm still the same old person, it seems. So at that time, if we look how far we have to go, we'll become further discouraged. At that time, we need to look at how far we have come. We need to look at how far we have come. If we look at our own lives, a few years ago, a few decades ago, there is a significant difference, substantial difference, often a dramatic difference that is there. And how has that come? That has come by the process of Krishna consciousness. So if we want to be encouraged, we need to look at, if we are feeling discouraged, then we look at how far we have come. When we look at how far we have come, then that will make us, give us the faith, yes, the process does work. We are moving, I may be moving forward slowly, and sometimes our bhakti seems to be like we make two steps forward and sometimes we think I have taken three steps backwards. But actually, we are taking steps forward and we are moving on towards Krishna. So when the mind starts discouraging us, and by remembering how far we have come by the practice of bhakti, that can give us encouragement that this process does move on. This process does take us forwards. So on a regular level, every day we will face the same problem. Sometimes lust will come, sometimes anger will come, sometimes the anarthas will keep troubling us. And if we try to check our purification based on the day-to-day fluctuations of our consciousness, we may feel that, am I really getting purified? But These day-to-day fluctuations simply happen because we live in a highly materialistic society. But what we can see is the long-term change. Long-term change means that, say, now before I was introduced to bhakti, I used to love to eat eggs. And you know, now when we live in a temple, there is no exposure to that. But when I was coming on the flight to America, both the people who were sitting next to me, both of them were eating eggs. And you know, I just observed, it was almost like, it may seem odd, but it was almost like after 12 years I saw eggs for the first time. I had not even seen eggs. But then it just struck me that I did not feel any desire for that. Not only did I not feel any desire for that, but as what Yamunacharya says, I spit at the thought. So, what is this? You know, I just didn't feel any attraction. So, it struck me, yes, I have my own temptations, but there is a dramatic change that has happened. I hadn't even noticed it. But it has happened. So, there, all of us, if we look in our own life, then we might have had some conditionings which would have been very difficult to give up. But by the practice of bhakti, we have been able to give them up. So, if we try to look for our purification on a day-to-day basis, it will not work. It's like if a mother is taking care of the child, and every day the mother takes a tape and sees how much my baby has grown. You cannot measure the growth of your baby like that. The growth is a gradual process. So similarly, the bhakti lata bee that is growing in our heart, it's growing gradually. Every day we are hearing, chanting, it's growing, but it will be gradual. So, this, the mind, I was talking about denies reality. So, one way the mind denies reality is, I said it denies the reality that Krishna loves us. But another way the mind denies reality is that the process of bhakti works. By shifting our focus to the everyday struggles that we are going through, we start feeling, what is happening in my life? Is really this process making any difference? As long as we are in the material world, the adhyatmik, adhibhautik, adhidaivik, these kleshas are going to come for devotees and non-devotees. So externally, in some ways, our life may seem similar to that of non-devotees in terms of the problems that we face. But there's a world of difference. That is, suppose there are two patients in a hospital and both of them are in pain. But one of them is in pain because the disease has not yet been diagnosed and no treatment has been prescribed. And the other is in pain because the disease is not yet cured. But the disease has been diagnosed and the treatment has been prescribed. So although both may be in pain, but both are not at the same level. If both of them focus just on the emotion of the moment, if the patient who is being treated focuses only on the emotion of the moment, I'm taking treatment, why am I in pain? Why am I in pain? That may make the patient give up the treatment, thinking my pain is not yet gone. But if the treatment has been, if the disease has been accurately diagnosed, the treatment has been prescribed, then that pain is going to decrease and go away. So, like that, if we focus just on the events of the moment, whatever is happening, you know, we may feel that, yes, all the problems of life are there. My mind is giving me problems. What is the process of bhakti giving me? But if we see from the long-term perspective, our situation is very different from those who do not even know what is the problem or what the solution is. So by Krishna's mercy, Vaishnava Prabhupada's mercy, we are like that patient whose disease has been diagnosed and the treatment has also started. And by remembering how the treatment has worked in our life, how it has transformed our heart. By refusing to let the mind deny that reality, we can get the inspiration to move onwards. And as we keep moving onwards, in the process of bhakti, then we will start realizing and relishing Krishna's love more and more. And then susukham kartam avyayam. The process of bhakti will become joyful. So when does it become joyful? Sometimes we say that material enjoyment, material pleasure is temporary, but spiritual happiness is eternal. But one devotee asked me a question, he said, but you know, even spiritual happiness is temporary. I come to a temple, I dance in kirtan, I feel happy. When I go back, I no longer feel happy. So what is the difference? Material happiness is temporary, spiritual happiness is also temporary. No. Yeah, at our level, our spiritual happiness is not temporary. Our experience of spiritual happiness is temporary. Just like there are thick clouds which cover the sun. Then below the cloud there is darkness. And sometimes there is a crack in the clouds by which the sunlight streams in. So what this means is, the sunlight is always there, but sometimes the cloud is covering parts so that the light can stream in. Similarly, Thakur explains in Harinam Chintamani that the cloud of anarthas covers our consciousness. Krishna is the sun. He is the source of the supreme happiness. And what we call, what we may think is a temporary experience of spiritual happiness. Yes, sometimes I feel happy when I take darshan, sometimes I feel happy when I chant, sometimes I don't. What is happening? The sun is always giving light. But because of the clouds, we are not able to see the sun. We are not able to see the light. Similarly, Krishna is always the source of happiness. But sometimes because of the conditionings, because of the lower modes influencing us, then what happens? Our connection with Krishna gets cut. And because of which we are not able to experience the joyfulness of bhakti. But as we become purified, the clouds part more and more. And as the clouds part more and more, the sunlight starts streaming more and more. Tada rajastamo bhava kamalobhadayaschaye cheta etair anaviddham sthitam sattve prasidati. Now in the second chapter of the first canto, when the process of bhakti is described, it said by practicing the process of bhakti, tada rajastamo bhava, the lower modes go away. Kamalobhadayaschaye, greed and lust go away. Then cheta etair anaviddham, as the consciousness becomes purified, sthitam sattve prasidati. We become situated in goodness and then prasidati. Bhakti becomes joyful. And then evam prasanna manaso bhagavad bhakti yogataha bhagavat tattva vijnanam mukta sangasya jayate. Then prasanna manaso, we can practice bhakti joyfully, and then the truth of Krishna, bhagavat tattva vijnanam, the truth of Krishna's love becomes a living reality for us. So it is, so not only is the process of Krishna consciousness working, so I talk about denial of reality, I am talking the third part in it. The first part of denying reality is the reality of Krishna's love. Second is the potency of the process of Krishna consciousness. And the third is the happiness of Krishna consciousness. We all have experienced the happiness of Krishna consciousness sometime or the other. Some glimpses we have had. And those glimpses may be temporary for us now. That is because the modes, the conditioning of the modes interferes with our experience of Krishna. But as we become purified, that interference will become lesser and lesser. Our connection with Krishna will become stronger. And then we will be able to relish the happiness of Krishna consciousness more and more. So by meditating on whatever experiences of happiness we had in Krishna consciousness, we see that these are not just temporary like material pleasures, but these are advanced glimpses of what I am going to get in future as I become purified. And by that way, we can move onwards in our bhakti. And prasanna manaso, as I forgot this, we can practice bhakti joyfully. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about the mind denies, the mind neglects opportunity and denies reality. With respect to neglecting opportunity, I focused primarily on the how the mind converts guilt into pseudo-guilt. So guilt is meant to keep us away from wrongdoing. Guilt should come as a wall between us and wrongdoing. But pseudo-guilt makes us feel so bad about ourselves, but it makes us so self-centered, so disheartened in our practice of bhakti, that it comes between us and Krishna. And anything that comes between us and Krishna is maya, it is temptation. So, if we are becoming self-centered, then we need to know that that is a feeling which should give up. So, no, even if I am fallen, it doesn't matter. Even if I am sinful, it doesn't matter. Still, I have the opportunity to practice bhakti right now. So, whatever lower desires come within us, they come like spikes. Now, what we do in between those spikes is what is going to, in the long run, define our spiritual advancement. So, because of those spikes coming in, it may not be possible for us to be consistent, always practicing the same level of bhakti. But still, we can be resilient. Okay, I'm knocked down, but I'll rise again. So, the mind neglects opportunity means, because we have fallen once, the mind says, you stay fallen only. Just like a one boxer knocks down the opponent, and if the opponent who has been knocked down, he asks the person who is knocked down, will I be able to win? Never. So, the mind neglects opportunities. And by knowing that, we always have the opportunity to rise and practice bhakti, we can counter the mind. And the much more hope-giving way to counter the mind is to deal with the next step. The mind denies reality. So, our process practice of bhakti is not, or rather Krishna's love for us is not centered on who we are. It is centered on who He is. He is the all-loving Supreme Person. There is nothing that we can ever do that can make Him stop loving us. So, He is tireless in His love for us. And to the extent we live in the reality of His love, in the consciousness that He loves us, that will inspire us to try to direct our love towards Him. So, through scriptural study, we can remind ourselves of the reality of Krishna's love. And then, by experience, by observing ourselves, not in the same sense of day-to-day fluctuations, but in terms of long-term transformation, we can see that the process of bhakti works. It does purify us, it does transform us. And by remembering whatever experiences of bliss, happiness we had in bhakti, you can know this is what awaits me ahead once the cloud of conditioning gets purified. So in that way, by the mind denies the reality of Krishna's love, the reality of the potency of bhakti, and the reality of the happiness of bhakti. But by countering these denials, we can steadily progress in bhakti and come to the level of susukham kartam ave, the joyful practice of bhakti. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes, please.